The Bible and Modern Science with your host, Dr. Joseph Henson of the Science Faculty of Bob Jones University. Here is Dr. Henson.
Thank you. In the course of our discussing discontinuities, gaps in nature, that no evolutionary theory has been successful in bridging, we started off talking about the problem of how our universe got here, how nothing can give rise to something, how by an evolutionary process this can occur. And we have talked at some length about that. I have been on the last program, and I think hopefully this program will wind this up, just some general statements dealing with a variety of observations about galaxies, solar systems, planets, etc. There's a man by the name of Robert P. Kirshner who wrote an article entitled The Earth's Elements in the Scientific American in October of 1994. And a couple of comments that he made are I found very interesting. I hope you will as well. Quote, even though the rug in most astronomy departments is lumpy from all the discrepancies that have been swept under it, a factor of 1,000 demands attention. He is referring, of course, to the idea of the fact that matter in the universe is in lumps. It is not homogeneous as we might have expected from the Big Bang. Quote, the composition of the Earth is the natural byproduct of energy generation in stars and successive waves of stellar birth and death in our galaxy. We do not know if other stars have Earth-like planets where complex atoms formed in stellar cauldrons have organized themselves into intelligent systems, end quote. Now, there are a couple of things about these statements that are, in my opinion, nonsensical, but the conclusion is worth noting from an unregenerate scientist. We don't know where these elements, the astronomers don't know that these elements were formed in star systems, as he's talking about. But the reason for reading this to you is that he is admitting here that it is not known if other planets, if other solar systems have planets. Now, this article was 1994, and I made a comment a couple of programs ago about the fact that, to my knowledge, planets have not been discovered outside our solar system. Now, I want to go to an article that was published in 1997. This is by Gabrielle Walker, and the title of the article, The Pegasi Planet That Never Was, published in The New Scientist in March of 1997. This is one of those recent discoveries that have been widely touted as examples of planets that have been found around stars outside our own solar system. And I think you'll find the comments here interesting. Quote, the hopes of planet seekers have been dashed by a study claiming that the discovery in 1995 of a planet circling the sun-like star 51 Pegasi was probably a false alarm. The 51 Pegasi planet was the first ever seen outside our solar system, but a paper in this week's Nature by David Gray of the University of Western Ontario in Canada suggests the planet is really just a blip in the behavior of the parent star. The planet hypothesis fails for 51 Peg, says Gray. If Gray is right, several of the 10 or so new planets discovered since 51 Pegs could also be figments of stellar oscillations, end quote. As I've reminded you often, I am not an astronomer, but here we have astronomers, not fundamental Bible believers certainly, who are simply admitting the fact that in spite of all the publicity and all the rash of articles and videos and television programs and all the rest of it that came about as a result of that supposed discovery, it is entirely possible that they're not real planets, that they are simply blips that occurred as a result of some aberration of the star around which they are supposed to have formed. So again, it just means that it's wise to take with a rather large grain of salt many of the claims that we find evolutionists making. And it just, once you understand that the any theory that involves anything at a time period when man is not capable of perceiving it, it just is a guess. That's all. And even many of those, can you see stars? Certainly you can see stars. Can you get information? Yes, you can. But what does the information mean? This is the area that the trouble begins. Once you have accumulated these facts, how do you put them into a framework? And that process of putting them into a framework is not factual, is not absolute. It involves a person's preconceived opinions. It is going to be done in order to fit these things in with a view which each of the astronomers happens to have about it. Now, a gentleman by the name of Thompson, Dietrich E. Thompson, published an article entitled Astration and Galactic Evolution. It was published in Science News in November of 1976. Quote, "So even though we cannot watch a galaxy evolve the way we watch a flower grow, the operative question is not whether galaxies evolve, but how they form and how they change is one of the primary questions in astrophysics," end quote. Now, I find this interesting for a couple of reasons. We don't argue over whether stars are there or not. We don't fuss about that. We can see them. We can get some information back. But it touches on the thing I have just mentioned to you. Once that factual information is gathered, when you start trying to use that factual information as the demonstration of an assumption involved in an evolutionary theory, then you have gone from that which is reasonably certain to that which is absolute speculation. And the astronomers simply get to the place that after a while, they don't know the difference. They don't recognize any longer the difference between the speculation and the factual material that might have been the basis of that speculation. Now, a man by the name of Jerry Bishop wrote an article entitled New Theories of Creation. This was published in Science Digest in October of 1972. Quote, A.G.W. Cameron, a Goddard Institute lecturer and professor at Yeshiva University in New York, suggests that the creation of the solar system might have occurred in a matter of a few thousand years. Indeed, he suggests it might have taken place so rapidly that the Earth and some of the planets could have formed shortly before the Sun did, which, in view of the traditional thought, is a revolutionary proposal. Now, neither of these two people are creationists. And when they use the word creation, they are using that to mean some form of evolution. But what intrigued me was the time period on it. Astronomers usually talk in terms of billions of years, and here he's suggesting the possibility that creation would have been relatively brief in terms of millions of years. For a Bible, let me ask you this question. I think we've talked about this before, but it may have been some time ago. What was the first body that was created in our universe? If you accept the biblical account, that body was the earth, not the sun. Now, that may seem maybe news to some of you, maybe new. It may seem like utter nonsense to some of you, but at least this is what the scripture teaches. And I'm not intending to take a long time now to go into it, but I just mentioned that in passing because this astronomer has suggested the possibility himself. So here you have a non-Christian philosopher who is suggesting the possibility that the earth came into existence before the sun did. And that is a radical notion indeed. Now further in the article, quote, "To the surprise of scientists, the chemical makeup of the moon rocks is distinctly different from that of rocks on the earth. This difference implies that the moon formed under different conditions," Professor Cameron explains, "and means that any theory on the origin of planets now will have to create the moon and earth in different ways." And this could lead us to a lengthy discussion about the first trip to the moon and all that kind of thing. They were hoping that to find evidence that somehow the moon had gotten sucked out of the Pacific Ocean and so on and so forth, evidence for tremendous age. Everything the evolutionary astronomers wanted to find when they went to the moon, they found they did not find support for. And for that reason alone, this comment here I find rather interesting, to say the least. Now, Monica Grady, Ian Wright, and Colin Pillinger wrote an article entitled Opening a Can of Worms in Nature, August 15th, 1996. I wish we had time to read all that's here, but we don't. But there are several things that are worth your awareness of. Quote, but each supporting thread can be regarded as weak. Even the premise that the meteorite comes from Mars is disputable. What this article is dealing with is the well-publicized series of articles, television appearances, et cetera, involving meteorites at the South Pole that were supposed to have come from Mars, that were supposed to have microfossils in them. And if you keep up at all with current news, you're aware of the fact that this happened. Now, this article is really offering objections to almost every point that has been raised with regard to that, including, first of all, how in the world do the astronomers know these meteors came from Mars? Well, this one says that's disputable. I would agree heartily with that. To continue, quote, several reasons for caution on microfossils came from William Schopf at the NASA press conference. These so-called microfossils, they were supposed to have come from Mars on rocks. They are 100 times smaller than any such fossils found on the Earth. There is no measurement of the composition of the cells to show whether they're organic or not. Now, they're termed microfossils, but there's no way to establish that they're even organic. Now, the problem gets worse, as we'll note. There is no sign of any cavities to show that they're organic or not, and there is no sign, let me go back and read this sentence so we don't get them shut. They're 100 times smaller than any such fossils found on Earth. There is no measurement of the composition of the cells to show whether they're organic or not, and there is no sign of any cavities within the cells in which fluids necessary for life could reside. Some of the criteria used to identify microfossils in the terrestrial rocks are present in ALH84001, but one is not. The carbonates that harbor the microfossils are found in igneous rock rather than sediment. Here are supposed microfossils 100 times smaller than anything that we see. Their structure does not indicate they're fossils. There are not cavities in them, which are found in every cell that we know about. And they are found in igneous rocks, not in sedimentary rocks. Now, any one of those things would raise very large question marks about the nature of these fossils. Well, our time is gone again. We'll quit.
Thank you, Dr. Henson. You may send email to Dr. Henson at jhenson@bju.edu. That's jhenson at bju.edu. Or write to Dr. Joseph L. Henson, Box 34621, Bob Jones University, Greenville, South Carolina, zip code 29614, in the United States of America. You're invited to listen next time for The Bible and Modern Science.